Hello and welcome back to another episode of Inside the Esper Studios. My next guest is an author of a book called All the Noise at Once. She's also autistic and raising two kids out of her five that are autistic. So sit back, relax, and grab your favorite beverage, and I'll see you on the other side. See you there.
I wanna believe in the truth, but only see what I'm shown. Got the freedom to choose, but can't decide on my own. Follow what the group is thinking, bottle up my intuition till it's popping out the box that I don't fit in. I wanna believe in the truth, but only see what I'm shown. Got the freedom to choose, but can't decide on my own. Follow what the group is thinking.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Inside the Esper Studios. Today I'm joined with author Deandra Davis. Welcome to the show, Deandra.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Oh goodness. Why is that like the question someone asked me and then my mind goes blank? It's like, tell me about yourself. Now I know nothing about myself. I am an instructor at a university in South Florida, and so that's what I spend kind of most of my time doing, if that makes sense. Teaching other college students how to write properly, which they resent me for sometimes. I am a mom and a dog mom and a writer. That's something that's important. I'm a writer, I'm an author. My first book is coming out April 15th, 2025, and I'm very, very excited about that. And I love video games. That's me in a nutshell. I feel like I should have like a really good pitch of like, this is who I am, but goodness, the way my mind goes blank is horrible.
Okay, so growing up, did you feel different than everybody else?
Yes, I did. And I think that it's so hard. I struggled to keep friends growing up, which was like my biggest problem, was like that struggle to like keep friends, keep a friend group. Like, I can vividly remember how horrible that was. Like, how horrible those moments were and how uncomfortable it was and how out of step sometimes I think I felt with other people at times, right? Never quite like on the same, wavelength, almost trying to mimic everybody and kind of keep up with what they're doing and be more like them, so that maybe, I think even when I joined friend groups, sometimes I looked at who I felt the most liked person in the friend group was and tried to be a little more like them so that maybe people would like me too. But that was hard. I think I struggled a lot, and I switched through friend groups a lot because of stuff like that, right? Had a lot of people who just didn't really stay friends with me for one reason or the other, for no fault of mine a lot of times. And sometimes it felt like bullying, but it is what it is. But yeah, no, I definitely struggled a lot. And I noticed that the most when I think about how hard it was for me to like really keep friends and stay friends with people and deal with that. But I definitely never quite felt in step with people, if that makes sense. And that was always kind of hard.
Nice. So what people don't realize is you have autism and ADHD. When were you diagnosed?
Yeah, I'm actually, so I'm autistic and I'm bipolar. And I wasn't diagnosed until I was an adult. And that was interesting for me. So like, I was diagnosed as bipolar first, and then I was diagnosed as autistic really after. And so it's interesting because it was when I kind of started doing my own research and looking for a diagnosis to like try to figure out more about myself, because it really wasn't until my second son got diagnosed with autism where I was like, you like look at somebody and you're like, wait a minute, this looks familiar. Right? Like my son gets diagnosed and I'm like, what do you mean these things aren't normal? What do you mean? What do you mean these things aren't typical? What do you mean these things are autism? Tell me about this. 'Cause I really didn't know a lot about it. I will say that, right? One of the drawbacks I feel like that's so hard, Because like I come from a family of immigrants, like that's not something that they really knew about or understood to seek out any kind of diagnosis for. You know what I mean? And then like even when I was young, that I think that research and activism and everything for autism now is so much more than what it was even when I was a kid, you know? And so I think like the awareness is higher now. And then it's so much harder too because so many women who are autistic go undiagnosed. It's like, and it's 100% like such a thing, right? For especially like women who are autistic to go undiagnosed, especially as children. And so I think that there were so many factors that were kind of working against me, right? To get diagnosed as a kid, right? But I did. I got diagnosed as an adult mostly because I saw just so many similarities and things with my own child, right? That I was like, wait, maybe there's something here. I was like, I don't know. Let me check, right? And so I went through, and it was a long process. It was a very, very long process to get diagnosed because it's so much harder as an adult to get diagnosed. And so it was a long process. I was very, very lucky that my insurance covered it, but it was a long process. And I did end up getting diagnosed as an adult, and it was interesting. Interesting, I guess. So yeah, I didn't get diagnosed until I was an adult.
I mean, that seems to be the story of a lot of people I've talked to is the fact that they look at their child, and when their child gets diagnosed, they're like, wait a minute. You're saying, I see this, this, and this, and I do those same things. So you're saying what I've been doing is not normal, it's more an autistic trait. And you're like, oh my God.
Yeah, and it's like, wait,
Yeah, it's like,
what do
do
you
I need to be
mean?
tested too?
That was literally my experience. It was like, wait a minute, like, is this, do I need to be asking some questions now?
Yeah, I mean that seems to be what's going on with a lot of my older guests who have gotten diagnosed late in life is they're realizing they look at their child who's gotten diagnosed young and they're like, wait a minute, all those traits are
That's
mirror images
me.
of me. And
It's
then
like,
they get
wait, that's
tested. And then they look back at their life and they're like, oh my God,
And I think
everything
it's the
could take that.
look back. It's the look back that's like the most profound thing, because I remember like when I told my mom, when I told my, like when I got the diagnosis and then I told my mom, she like thought about it for a minute. And then she goes, "No, that makes sense."
I mean,
It's just so funny. It's just so funny to like have that experience because I'm like, yeah, like that's kind of like, because I feel like, oh my God, I can't even talk. It's just one of those things where I was thinking about it, and I was like, when I found out, I wasn't sure how to feel because it was validating. Like it was very, very validating, right? Because I had all of these things that I was struggling with, even in the process of getting diagnosed, because it was so many appointments. And I still remember even talking to like the neuropsychologist who diagnosed me and like taking the time and like going over things. And like even when I'm like, yeah, no, I struggled with friendships because of this, and I struggled with this because of this, and I had all these experiences, right? Like I was very like, even like little things that like I never thought about. Like, because maybe they're not the typical autistic experience. Like, I talked super early as opposed to late. I talked super early. Like, my mom still tells anyone who will listen that she was like stunned, right? She was like, oh, you were only like 9, 10 months old, like calling everybody's name in the house. She's like, by the time you were like barely a year, you were talking full sentences like a
Wow.
4-year-old. Like the doctors, she's like, the doctors were like, what is this? She's like, you were talking like full sentences like a 4-year-old. She's like, but then you're like 18 months and not walking. And we're like, what is happening? Why isn't she walking? And so I'm like, it's so interesting. She's like, and she'll also tell anybody who would listen, she's like, no, at 3 years old, she was reading. Like she was sitting, she was reading books, you know, at 3. And like that's something that like most people are like, That sounds fake, but like, no, I was like super like hyperlexic as a kid. Like, I was reading things way above grade level from like a super early age. Like a super early age. And I would just, and it was like ridiculous. Like, I'd read like an 800 page book in like one sitting, not eating, not sleeping, not remembering to go to the bathroom, nothing. It's just read, like locked in. And yeah, nobody tells you that that's hyper focusing. Nobody tells you that that's you hyper focusing too close to the sun. Nobody tells you that, right? Nobody tells you like, oh, this is your special interest and that's why. That's why. And oh, I'm sorry, you're forgetting to eat because, oh, you missed all those hunger cues that normal people feel all the time. Like, that's the thing. Like, there were so many like little things. And I think like even as I figured them out, I'm like, wow, that is so funny. 'Cause like I just thought that that's I just thought that this is how life was, right?
I mean, so when you got your diagnosis and you began to look back, you began to see things make more and more sense to you.
Yeah, definitely. Especially with just like being, especially when it came to like understanding my limits in terms of like being overstimulated and how I dealt with those things and how I felt about those things. And I'm very interesting in that like I shut down. Like, I don't like lash out. Like, I'm like shut down. So like I get overstimulated and I'm like in a bubble. Like, cannot, like, please, nobody talk to me. I can't function. I can't deal with things. Halloween was yesterday and I wore the most elaborate costume. Love the costume. I was Bakugo from My Hero Academia and I love my costume, but I was also so overwhelmed with it. Multiple times I kept pulling pieces off because I'm like, this is squeezing my arm. I can feel this on me. Like, it's driving me. So I could only wear some of the pieces for so long because before I was like, I'm literally about to lose my mind. So it's nice though, because I think like before I would kind of not understand why I felt like that, or I would not understand why I felt those ways. And like now I understand myself better and I can treat myself better, I think, and understand just being more understanding of my limits and being able to verbalize more like this is what's going on with me, rather than not understanding and feeling like my feelings were irrational.
All right. Now let's fast forward. You have three kids now.
I have five kids.
Five kids. Wow.
I have five kids.
Two of them are autistic. What is it like raising two kids who are neurodiverse, who are almost mirror images of you and your traits?
Yeah, so like my oldest is ADHD, which is interesting, and then the one right under him is autistic. And I think it is interesting raising neurodiverse children, because I find that in some ways you understand, right? Which is nice, right? Because you understand, right? Like, you can kind of meet them where they are, but also at the same time, we both have like limits. And so like, and I think especially with my son who's autistic, like, I think it's interesting seeing I think seeing him reminds me all the time that autism is a spectrum, right? Because sometimes I feel like he and I are on two very, very opposite ends of the spectrum. Like, again, example, yesterday was Halloween and we went trick-or-treating at my mom's house, and my mom has all of these decorations and like so many of them make noise. Like, they're all like they make all these like cackling noises and spooky noises and all this stuff makes noise, but they were like sound activated, right? So like you would have to like make a noise somewhere near them. My son, who was autistic, spent like 40 minutes just in the room with the toys, just like clapping to set them off, and every single time they got quiet he'd clap to set them off again. And like, that's what's getting him going, right? He loves that, right? He needed that repetitive, he needed that constant input. Me, on the other hand, I'm like in the other room going, oh my God, if that goes off one more time, I'm literally going to lose my mind. Oh my God, please, it's too much input, right? Like, he is, and he's been like that. Like, he's always needed more input. right? Like very like hypo. Like he's always needed more input. He's always needed to move more than other kids, jump around more than other kids. He's always needed more feedback, always needed more noise, more everything. Whereas like I'm almost like the opposite, where I'm like, I need less. I need less of that. I need less of that. I need everything to just calm down, please. It's too loud. It's too bright. It's too much happening. I'm very overwhelmed. And so it's very, very interesting because it's like I understand why he feels that need, but I also understand that I need the exact opposite, right? I need the exact opposite of the things that he needs. But I think that it's good, because I think I've learned, like I said, how to meet their needs and how to better understand them and look out for them and advocate for them. I think the advocacy is so important. I think because I now especially know how much I need to advocate for myself, it makes me fight harder to advocate for them and the things that they need. Like I am the nicest person. I'm the nicest person, but like start messing with my kids' IEPs and 504 plans, and now we have a problem.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't realize the importance of an IEP. I've talked with many, many people who work with the parents and the children to sit down in a meeting with the teachers in the school to write the correct IEP to get the kids what they need, the support they need, and everything else.
No, and it's so important. And I think, and it's horrible because just recently, like I felt like I had to be like that very like yelly parent, right? Because like we moved, and we moved into a new county. And because we moved into a new county, like my kids' 504 plans, they didn't automatically come over. Like they needed to update it for the current county. But the problem was, I brought all the paperwork over like they asked me to. They told me, yes, everything is being applied. Don't worry, everything's fine, right? And I knew I had a meeting for one of my kids, but the other one, they told me, like, oh, the meeting's gonna happen. Don't worry about it. We're making sure that we apply it and we're gonna update it later. And I was like, okay, that's fine. And because I like to be a patient person, and I understand, again, like I work in education, maybe not the K through 12, but I do understand that educators are so busy and they're working hard and they have so much going on, especially in K through 12, right? And so I'm understanding. It's fine. My oldest son, like I said, who has ADHD, he's struggling a little bit, that he's having some problems. I have concerns because I'm like, okay, is his 504 being applied? Like I email one of his teachers and they're like, yeah, no, it's being applied, don't worry about it. And I was like, okay. And I want to make sure, right? Because testing's coming up, all this stuff is coming up. I want to make sure he's getting his extra time. He's getting all the things that he needs, right? Okay. Fast forward to this school year. So, like, this was last school year. Fast forward to this school year. I'm meeting his new teachers. It's now open house. One of his teachers stops me and is like, oh, yeah, you emailed me. I don't have anything about a 504. Are you sure that something is there for a 504? I said, what do you mean? You don't have anything for a 504. Oh no, we don't have anything on record. But I dropped everything off and they told me last year it was being applied. So who lied to me? Someone lied to me. And like now I'm angry, right? Like now I'm losing my mind because the reason my child was struggling is because, you know, he was going all this time without his accommodations. These very, very, very needed accommodations. And so like now I'm freaking out and I'm losing my mind because I find this out like just before another round of testing was about to happen. And I'm like, no, someone needs to fix it. Someone needs to fix it. My kid needs their accommodations. What are you guys doing? And like now I'm freaking out. And like I know I look like the crazy parent, but I know, again, I just, because I have dealt with it myself and I do deal with it myself, I understand so how important accommodations are and how needed they are and how much our kids need us to advocate for them.
I mean, that is so important. I mean, especially as we get older and we gotta pass that on to our kids, because when they get into school and then they get into college, it's the important lesson of you need to advocate for yourself. I'm not gonna be there. If you go away to school, I won't be there. You gotta speak up. And I ran into that. When I
Yeah.
went away to school, I had one professor who was very stubborn. Everyone else, all my other professors were great. This one guy, after our class, I walk up to him and I'm like, I'm gonna need some private time with you because I'm having trouble understanding the material. He's like, if I help you, I gotta help everyone else. I can't help you right now. I walked away. I came at him again. I'm like, you gotta help me. I don't want to fail this class. And he's like I told you last time, if you, I gotta help everybody else. I'm like, well, it's in my records that I get help. And I've been told that you will give me help. I walked away third time. He's like, okay, meet me in my office. He tried to explain it to me, and it still went over my head. Time after that, he sent me to another professor who teaches the same subject. Still, I wound up failing that one course.
And it's so hard.
I mean, there are two types of learners, but for those of us who are autistic, we're either visual learners or we're physical learners. And I'm the kind who's more of a visual learner where you have to sit down with me and explain it step by step. And if you don't do that, my mind can't absorb it.
And I think that the it's so hard, I think, and it's so funny because so many people like ask me, because like I went to like a really small college, and like whenever people are like, oh, didn't you want to go to big fancy college? I'm like, yeah, I feel like I thought I wanted to go to a big fancy college until I went to like a really small college and I realized how much better that experience was. Right? Like, I think it can be so difficult to add, like you said, just to advocate for yourself and to make sure that those needs are being met, and to make sure that people are doing their due diligence. I feel like it's difficult, right? Especially in the education system, it can be so hard, and it feels like an upwards fight, I think. But I think that, again, me having my own stuff, and like me being autistic, like I think that it has made me more understanding, like as a professor, like any student that I have that comes through that has any sort of accommodations, I always make sure that those are met. I always, even for the students who don't officially have accommodations, even for the students who are like, I think I have ADHD and I'm dealing with that and I'm trying to get diagnosed, or whatever the case may be, and you don't have anything on record, like I'm always trying to meet my students where they are, just because like I understand how hard that is, I understand how hard that is. Like, I have students who come to me and they tell me, like, I think I have ADHD. I've always thought it, but like, my family doesn't believe in that kind of stuff. So I'm just trying to get that help on my own, And like, I'm just like, no, like, just tell me what you need, and I'll try to meet you there. Like, I encourage my students to come to my office hours. I'm like, I'm sitting there by myself. Come talk to me if you need something, right? Like, and I do always appreciate the professors who can do that. I mean, I understand also the ones who can't, but I always think that it means something to help people, especially in marginalized communities, right? Who are just trying to fight to be kind of where everybody else is,
I mean, I know that's so true. I mean, because you have one professor who's really good, and then you have one professor who's really bad, and it's just about them helping you. It's not their problem, it's your problem, because I don't want to be the one who's failing your class. It's because, and I applaud you for telling your students, hey, if you got a problem, please come talk to me in my office, because I will work with you. I mean,
Yeah, I just had a student the other day. She sat in my office for 2 hours. I
it's
did not I and I didn't rush her. We just sat, we talked about both things that she was struggling with and things that she needed help with, but also just life, and just sharing things with me. And she was struggling kind of with the college experience, right? Like, she's a freshman and she's dealing with the transition from that, and she's from out of state and she's dealing with the transition from that. And I just sat and talked with her, and I do feel like sometimes, like, people don't realize, like, a lot of these students, they need that. Sometimes they really need that. Sometimes they don't know what to do, who to turn to. They're struggling, they're floundering, and like, sometimes they just need to know that they have like a space that they can come and talk to someone.
I mean, colleges here can learn a lot from the colleges in Europe. Because not only did I have an academic advisor, I had a disability advisor, I had a well-being advisor, and each one had their own thing. And it was so important. The well-being advisors were the ones who made sure you understood what was going on, that you were eating right, that you were settling okay. And then they would get you all set up. I mean, colleges need to learn. You are going to have your spectrum of people who are either on one side of the spectrum or the full end or the other, or have ADHD and have problems focusing, and then you need that focus, because otherwise they're just going to flounder in class.
Yeah, no, and I think I've definitely seen that, and I do. I mean, I think it's so funny because I think I say even now, and I reflect on it, I'm like, I think, and I mean, it could just be my department. I can't speak for every department, but I'm like, I think we are so much nicer now than we were when I was in college. I was like, I feel like they used to be mean. But like not necessarily like the college, like my undergrad was great. Even my grad school was great. But like I started college and then like took a break and then went back, you know? And like my like first go around before I took that break, oh no, I had a horrible experience. I had a horrible experience. It was awful. And I think it was my second experience, like in like having taken that break to like kind of figure myself out and then go back a little bit. After I think in doing that is like when I experienced like really, really great professors, really, really caring people, really, really good experiences. But no, like that bad experience can mean something. But I do feel like in some ways, like, and like I said, I can't speak for every department, but I know like especially like in my department, like we try to do everything that we can to look out for students. Is like even like in my department with all of our intro English classes, we have a week built in just to do conferences to like at midterm time to check in and be like, how are you doing? What do you need? This is where you're at right now. How can I help you be successful? Right. And I love that, right? I love things like that. And I think that it is so considerate of the student. And I think that it really helps them because I think it does understand that like I think sometimes we automatically think like, oh, you're adults now. You're in college, you're adults now. But like they are still very much kids. Like some of my students are still 17, you know? Like some of my students are still 17. Some of them aren't even 18 yet. I was only 17 when I first started college. And so I think that so many of them really are still in that transition period where they're trying to figure things out and, you know, trying to learn. And I think that it's good for us to like you said, like to both be that resource for them and also hand them those resources. Like I'm always telling my students about the resources on campus that they can go to for like wellness and mental health and whatever they may need, like if they're struggling, so that they're not just floundering, so that they understand like, hey, I know where I can turn to if things get difficult. And I think that that's so important.
Yeah, I mean, parents don't realize that, yeah, your kids are away, but the problem becomes there is nobody on top of them.
Yep,
There is
that's
nobody, yeah, there is nobody saying, do this, do that, do this. It's like they get total freedom, but it becomes, I need to figure out how to balance my work with my
with
playtime.
everything else. Yes, and that's the one thing that my student, my freshmen especially struggle with the most. And those are the conversations I have with them. And that's what I tell them. I tell them all the time, I'm like, listen, there is nobody here to be on your butts. Like really, there's nobody here to be on your butts about things. And I know that sometimes y'all are gonna let things snowball. Don't try your best, right? Try your best not to. And sometimes I even tell them, I'm like, listen, set alerts in your phone if you need to. Tell people around you if you need to so that they can remind you. One of the biggest things that I even tell students to do, I'm like, join a club. Join a club, join a sorority, join a fraternity, join something that requires a minimum GPA to stay in the group. I know that like sounds weird, but I'm like in all seriousness, I'm like the more community you have, the better you're going to do because you're not going to want to lose that community. You're not going to want to get kicked out of school or something bad happens, like with your grades where you can no longer be a part of that. I'm like, get involved, still balance, but get involved with people who are going to help hold you accountable. Right? Like get involved with honor societies. Get involved, like, and people are always surprised when I say sororities or fraternities, but I'm like, they require a minimum GPA to join and to stay in.
Oh, that I didn't know.
Yes, they require a minimum GPA to join and to stay in. If your GPA drops below a certain amount, like, you can get kicked out of a sorority or fraternity. So a lot of times there's people around you holding you accountable to be like, hey, are you doing what you need to do? Because we don't want you to get kicked out of the group, you know? And so, like, as crazy as that sounds, like, I try to almost give my students, because I'm like, it's so hard to have that internal motivation right now. So I almost try to get them to find new people to stay on your butts, find new reasons, of things to stay on top of you so that you can have something holding you accountable, other than yourself, right? Because it can be difficult sometimes to learn how to have that intrinsic motivation.
All right, now let's move forward a little bit. You wrote a book. Did you draw your inspiration from your book from your son?
I did. Both from myself and my son, right? Because so many parts of it are obviously me, right? But again, it's a spectrum, and I think I didn't want it to just be like a self insert, but I did, right? Especially because, like, my main character is a male black boy with autism. Obviously, I am not a male boy with autism, right? But I did draw a lot of inspiration from my son and really just my family in general. I think there are parts of him in here, right? Again, it's not a self insert. I think that I took a few of his quirks, a few of my quirks, and things that I've seen, and in some ways my worries, if that makes sense. I think that I worry about him. He's still relatively young now. But I do think a lot of my worries about what his life is going to be like as he gets older, the interactions that he may have, right? Being a black male with autism, and kind of a lot of my fears surrounding that, I think really were a big influence for this book, right? Because I do understand, and obviously it does touch on, interactions with the police and things like that. And I think that I thought a lot about that. I thought about, the time, and it happened right here in Florida, that there was a man, and he was a white man. He was older, but I think he had gotten out of a home, and his caregiver, he was autistic, and his caregiver was trying to get him back, and he was like in the middle of the street, and these police have like guns pointed on him, and his caregiver is like shielding him and is like, please do not shoot. He is autistic. He is not going to hurt anybody. Like, just please don't shoot. And like, they shot anyway. They hit the caregiver. Like, they didn't hit him, but they hit the caregiver. And I was just like, why would y'all do that? Like, why would y'all do that? Like, why was that the right way to handle this situation? And I realized, like, that was like, I think about that, right? Like, him growing up in a world where there are people who don't have the patience to understand, right? Like a meltdown, right? Or they don't have the patience to understand that maybe you're not processing potentially conflicting instructions, right? Because I have been in situations with police where they have given me conflicting instructions. I've been like, okay, what do you need me to do? Sorry, but I've been in situations like that, and I worry, and so yeah, he was definitely a really, really big influence.
All right. What was your writing process like?
A lot of procrastination, which is horrible. I think a lot of thinking about it. It started as kind of like a short story that grew into something larger. And then I want to say, and this is my problem, is like I said, like I procrastinate. It's like a lot of thinking about what I'm gonna do. and thinking about putting it on paper and not actually putting it on paper because I'm not a good plotter. I'm not a good like outliner of like, oh, I'm gonna make an outline and plot everything out. I'm not that. Like, I'm very, very much like a pantser. I have to just sit and see what comes out. But I want to say, like, my writing process, again, like I said, I'm not a big plotter, but I did have the overall shape of the idea and it changed a lot over time. Different elements got added over time. The football element was the last element to get added, which was interesting. The element of him being a football player was something that got added last, right? I think it had always started with this autistic character and his brother. That was always something that I knew I wanted to do. So it started with the characters, and that's how I knew I wanted it. And the characters have always been the same, but things changed over time. But yeah, I think for me, I'm not good at like, as much as there are so many people who are just like, no, write every single day. I am not good at that. I'm not good at that. I'm not the person to look at to be like, yeah, write every day and be consistent and this and this. I'm not good at that, right? I'm not good at things like that. So I write when I have time. There are days when I write 10,000 words and there are days when I write 0 words. So my writing process really varies, and sometimes it also depends on kind of like where I'm at mentally and whether or not I can kind of deal with that right now. But yeah, so my writing process was very, very much like trying to figure out the shape of the idea and like where I wanted to start, who I wanted the characters to be, what I felt like the overall shape was without, like I said, without writing that down because I don't plot or outline anything, which is horrible and I need to do better. Well, I don't know. You know, some people, a lot of us are pantsers and we're valid, but I had to just kind of figure that out and figure out the shape of the story. And I think once I really knew, like, I feel like once the football element got added, I was like, wait, I think I have something. And I think I can see this for what I think I want it to be. And then I was able to just kind of sit down and just bang it out. And then once it's on paper, it's just a lot of revision, right? Like a lot of going back and revising. And I have revised this book so many times, so many times that it does not look anything like what it did when I first wrote it. And that's okay, and I'm proud of that. But I've definitely revised it a bunch of times, and I think the revision process is actually kind of my favorite part of the writing process. I love kind of making changes and kind of looking at those what ifs and the what could be's and what if we did this. And I love kind of the back and forth, especially if I'm working with someone for revision. I really, really love that process. So yeah, no, I definitely that is my writing process. I don't even know if I answered your question accurately, but
What was the hardest thing about writing your book?
that's a really good question. I almost think the hardest thing about writing the book was maybe, again, like I said, so much of this book is kind of born of my own like concerns and fears. And I do think that in writing and putting a lot of those things to paper, sometimes it was a very emotional experience for me. And so there are quite a few scenes like in the book where I actively cried while writing them. You know, like I actively was like crying while getting it out on paper, and that was really, really hard for me, I think. Like, I guess just putting fears to paper and putting concerns to paper and almost giving that fear almost like a voice, I believe was the hardest part for me.
You're right. What was it like writing it? I mean, a lot of people say it's like climbing a mountain. People call it the labor of love. What would you say it was like for you?
That's good, because now I have to find a metaphor, and I'm not always the best with those. You'd think, right? Because I'm a writer. you'd think I'd be great with metaphors. I want to say it's a marathon, right? I think that that's the best metaphor, and that's also what I say, kind of in my acknowledgments, right? Is that writing a book is a marathon. It's something where You have to learn how to keep pace. There's going to be times when you're moving faster, where you're moving slower, where you need to stop for a second, where you need people along the way to kind of help you, give you encouragement, people that are giving you kind of cups of water along the way, right? Like things like that, right? Where it can't really happen in a vacuum. Hopefully you're running with other people, but there are going to be stretches where it's just you. And that can be hard and isolating, and sometimes you're in community, sometimes you're not. But when you cross the finish line, it's always super, super rewarding. And so I definitely think that writing for me felt kind of like a marathon, right? There are highs and lows to it. But yeah. Yes.
What kind of recognition, even though your book hasn't been out yet, it's not out till next year, has it gotten any kind of recognition?
Surprisingly, yes, right? I think one of the things I'm most excited about and so grateful for, it was just recently recognized by the American Booksellers Association, as their top 10 indies introduced kids lit pick. And so, amazing booksellers from all across the country came together and read a bunch of kid lit books, so many submissions from all over and so many different publishers, and deigned to pick my book as one of 10 that they really anticipate to be great, and want to support and kind of throw their weight behind for the winter spring season of 2025. And I'm amazed by that, right? Like, for the entire year they only picked 20 kid lit books. And I think even like what's even crazier to me is that, like, that kid lit list, right? So, like, the adult list is like 10 adult books, but the kid lit list is young adult, middle grade, right? Like, all of these, like, different kid lit age ranges. And so I want to say that there's only like five young adult books on that, right, larger 10, and for it to just be one of those five young adult books, or maybe there's six, because I think there's a young fiction, a nonfiction one, but to be kind of like, like one of 10 or even less than that, because it's not all young adult, right? It's also middle grade and other age ranges. Yeah, to be included in that is just such a huge honor. And so I'm so happy about that, and I feel so grateful.
Now, here's the hard question. What was it like handing off your book to your publisher? Because a lot of people say it's like handing your baby to them, but to a stranger.
It feels like that. Oh, goodness. It can feel like that. I think it's funny. I think maybe because I really trust my editor, like truly, like shout out to my editor, shout out to you, Julia, if you're listening, right? She's amazing. And I think maybe if I had signed with someone else or someone who I didn't feel got it would have felt maybe worse, right? Or even scarier or something like that. But I think it's hard, because you do feel like you're handing over like a piece of yourself, especially this book that has, like I said, so much of me and almost like my family in it. You do feel like you're handing off a piece of yourself. It's like handing over a pound of flesh, right? But I do feel like I have just immense trust in my editor, and so it definitely didn't feel like I was handing it to a stranger, which is nice. I definitely felt like I was passing it off to someone who understood and who got it and who wanted to see all the great things that I wanted to see out of it. And so, but it definitely does feel like that pound of flesh handoff, I'm not gonna lie. Feels like cutting off your arm and being like, here you go.
All right. What was the best thing? What was the hardest thing about writing your book, and what was the best thing about writing your book?
Yeah, like I said, the hardest thing is definitely like those emotional scenes. I think the best thing may not have been anything within the writing process, which is weird. Like, not saying that there weren't great things about the writing process, right? Like finishing and selling, and those are all best things, right? But I think for me, truly, it's now in that like early reviewer stage, where there are now people getting very early copies and reading. And like, one of the first reader reviews I got was, another autistic person who was just talking about how seen they felt. And just, it was just the most beautiful review. Like they were pulling quotes from the book that they loved and just talking about the ways in which, they appreciated the book and how they felt seen on the page. And I, for me, that's the best thing. Like the book finding the people that need it, that I don't feel like there's literally anything that's ever going to beat that.
Do you plan on writing any more books?
Yes, I do have a second book in my contract, and that's coming sometime later. And so I do plan on writing more books, and I'm also working on just kind of breaking out into other spaces, other age ranges, and trying to get as much really, really cool neurodiverse representation on the page as I possibly can.
What advice do you have for aspiring authors who are also autistic?
I think the one thing that I would say, especially to specifically autistic writers, right? Don't be afraid to put yourself in this. Don't be a like it's I do feel like we mask so much and we try to be sometimes like other people so much and like what's trending, right? And right now I've been so excited to see so many I've seen so many more book deals now with like autistic writers, like actual autistic writers writing autistic main characters, and it makes me so happy, right? Like there is a space for us. There is a space for us, and there is a space for us to like actually be ourselves, not like what people think we look like or what they want us to be, but like really be ourselves. And so like don't be afraid to put who you are and your version of the spectrum on paper, because autistic people need that, right? Like we don't need just one type of autism being displayed, right? Like please bring all of the stories, bring all of the stories, and be as authentic as you possibly can be, because someone is going to resonate with it, and it's so useful and so helpful for so many people.
And finally, where can people find out more about you and possibly pre-order your book?
Okay, so I am mostly on Instagram at Deandra Writes. So that's like my first name and then Writes. I'm mostly on Instagram. If you happen to pop over there, you can see, me promoting my book, but also awesome Halloween costumes. That's always fun. But I think that's where I spend a lot of my time. And then you can always look at my website where I will be updating it for things like events that are coming, places that I'm going to be, and that is deandradavis.com. And to pre-order my book, it is available at almost every retailer that I can think of. If you want a really, really cool signed and personalized copy, you can pre-order it from Books and Books. And that is Books and Books. It's in Florida, but they ship anywhere. But you can pre-order it from Books and Books to get a personalized and signed copy. But if you don't necessarily need that, right, it is at other retailers like Barnes and Noble and Amazon and all those other retailers.
That's it, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Reed Miles. That was Deandra Davis. And I'll see you on the next one. See you there. Thank you, Deandra.
Thank you so much. This was so fun. I so appreciated talking to you.